Today, I welcome Laura Impalamini to the In Conversation With podcast for Women in Jazz Media with myself, Hannah Horton. Laura is a jazz trombonist, composer, and musical director of various projects. In 2020, she graduated with distinction from her MMus in jazz trombone from Trinity Laban Conservatoire of Music and Dance, where she studied improvisation and composition under world famous musicians. She went on to receive the Arts Council Develop Your Creative Practice funds to compose a collection of original contemporary jazz compositions under skilled mentorship featuring trombone as the lead instrument. Hello, Laura. How are you?
Hello. I'm good. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm good. Thank you. It's a not very bright April day here. How about where you are?
Yeah, I'm in a studio with no windows, so it's not very bright.
So how is 2024 going for you so far?
It's very musical. I'm feeling very grateful for lots of different musical opportunities that are around, some new projects, some old projects with new opportunities. So I've been really focusing on my practice in upping the discipline and intensity of it.
So practice as in playing your instrument, or practice as in having to do all the organisation and all of that stuff that goes with it?
I was referring to the instrument, particularly like a lot of transcribing and learning new tunes and also working on my tunes. But because of an increased sort of focus and commitment on my music, with that comes also a necessity to tend to more admin.
Yeah, that's the loving word we give to all of that stuff that we don't really want to do. Admin. Isn't it?
Yeah, I've got mountains of it.
Yeah, it's hard work being an independent musician like that, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's a lot of self-motivating. So whether that's in our practice, you know, of the instrument and jazz as an art form or composition, but then this sort of constant need to promote everything we're doing, to network and try and create more opportunities so that the trajectories have a future and a forward momentum. And then, of course, like each band, all the relationships within it, all the logistics from gigs to rehearsals to invoices and so on. It's like, you know, this real multitasking that's involved in being band leader or a self-employed musician.
Yeah. So what projects do you have on the go at the moment?
So there is my quintet of original compositions. So I've got some gigs coming up for that and sort of leading into recording an album that I will release later this year. So we'll be playing Love Supreme Festival and some gigs in London and around. And then I have an 11-piece Afro jazz band called Yamaya. We released our debut album last year on Funky Walla. So we've got some gigs coming up with that in Brighton and Sussex. And then I also co-run a sort of swing collective, I guess you could call it, a Sunday afternoon jazz gig where we're a collective of musicians, but pretty much always a quintet that I'm in relationship with the venue and all the musicians coordinating that. So there's three main projects. And then I play in other projects. I play as a trombonist with the Dub Sound System. So we have some things coming up with that. I play in an all-female brass band, so we've got things coming up with that, and then bits of depping and studio work here and there.
Great. The 11-piece must be a nightmare to organise.
Yes.
11 diaries. Oh, my goodness.
Logistical hell.
How does it work then? How do you do that?
Coffee. it's me and 10 men, which adds a whole other layer of challenge to it. There's an enormous gender imbalance. It's a project that is, when I set it up, I was very early actually in my musical development, And I think essentially inexperience, let's say, knowing now what I know, would I set up an 11 piece? Not in a million years. But back then I was like, I love the big Afro sound. You know, you don't really get it so much anymore, but like big reggae bands, big Afrobeat bands, we've got two guitars and five piece horn section, and you get that huge sound. But, you know, the logistical cost of that is huge. And also, you know, logistical from rehearsals through to the fact that when you're performing and you're a band that large, obviously it's not very lucrative because you're splitting the fee between so many musicians. But I do believe the sound is great, but organizing it is, it's almost like I have to do it in short, sharp, intense bursts before I get too frustrated with it and have to put it down. So I'm currently organizing some rehearsals and it's like, okay, just, okay, take a deep breath. When can everyone rehearse? I just have to just do it in this little tolerable burst and then put it down because it's frustrating. It's herding cats when you're trying to get answers out of musicians.
Yeah, really hard. But it sounds very heartfelt that actually you're just doing it, for, you know, it was formed and you're doing it for the love of the music and the sound, which I really adore the sound of that. But oh my goodness, it's a bit, I have trouble organizing J Steps and yeah. They're under 18s and they should be around a lot of the time. So for you guys, oh my God.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very complex. And it kind of got to this point of essentially, you know, I've always felt very firmly that like the horn section, which is a five piece horn section, like that is the sound. It's this wall of horns. But, you know, not having five horns is a luxury. Having two guitars is a luxury. But if we take the horn section as my area of expertise, you know, I feel very firmly like the peripheries of the horn section have to be there. We need the barry and the trumpet and one of the other horns in the middle. But the trumpet and the barry are like essential because they're the peripheries. But the reason I say this is there's been a real sort of coming to this awareness of like, okay, we can't always be all 11. That's unrealistic. And also, so where can the sacrifices be tolerated? And then equally this sort of willingness to use more depths because, you know, it's not going to function otherwise. So at the moment, I'm in the process of training up about five depths for different instruments that are often not available. And then having a sort of bank there of a pool of musicians that can be drawn on. But yeah, as I say, if I knew what I know now, I don't know if I'd have set it up, but I am proud of the music we've created and it's always really well received when we play. So that kind of fuels the fire to be like, just keep it going. You know, it doesn't, it's not my only baby, musical baby, but it's one I care for.
Mm. And then one of your other projects is the quintet.
Yeah.
And you have a gig coming up for Women in Jazz Media with them. Is it with the quintet?
Well, it's actually that gig is a trio gig.
Oh.
So it's with two members of the quintet.
Right.
Apparently the venue is very small and they couldn't quite have all of the quintet there.
Right.
So there will be the keys player from the band and the tenor player. I felt like that would be, for me, the most fun way to play it because the keys player is quite adept at also functioning as a bassist. And I thought it would be a good experiment to see where we could take it. But yeah, that's on the 25th of April. We're playing at Caramel in London and we'll be playing quite a few of my favourite standards and then a few of my compositions that will function in a trio setup. Not all of them function without the rhythm section in its full form. So that I think, you know, there'll be a little smattering of my compositions in there. But aside from that 25th of April trio one, then I have some other gigs coming up with the full quintet.
Yeah, and you said at the start that you have some gigs with that full lineup and then you're going into the studio. So do you treat sometimes the gigs as a kind of warm-up sort of semi-rehearsal thing before going into the studio or how do you work with that?
Yeah, definitely. I think when recording live improvised music, it needs to be really played in and there needs to be like a musical union or established relationships between the musicians. So with Yamaya, the 11-piece Afro Jazz, and the lead up to recording that album, I arranged a sort of mini tour of gigs to play the music in and also raise the funds to record the album. And so similarly with my quintet, I've organized, tried to organize a few gigs leading up to it, just so that, you know, that there's a, that the music matures and the musical relationships do too.
And you got funding for this one that's coming up, didn't you?
Yeah, from Help Musicians, a really great musical charity. I got their record and release grant to record and release the music. So fortunately, as you said at the beginning, I got the Arts Council Develop Your Creative Practice grant, which I used to actually compose the body of work and develop my capacity as a composer. And now with Help Musicians, that grant, I'm going to actually record and release it.
So with the first one, with the Develop Your Creative Practice, what else did you, so obviously you wrote the music, but did you see some mentors, or how did that work develop? So, and who did you see? Talk us through it.
So that grant specifically, I really was very aware during, I did a master's in jazz at Trinity, and where I started composing, but my experience in Trinity was very much like constantly questioning. We're playing jazz, this is a black music form, it's born out of slavery. If you understand the history and the roots of jazz music, it's rooted in slavery. Yet, if you study jazz in a conservatoire in the UK, at that point in time, it was a very white experience, very white middle class experience. I think on the whole course, there were two teachers that taught me two combos. Other than that, all the teachers were white and male. And those two teachers who taught me the combos, who were people of global majority, Larry Bartley and Byron Wally, Wallen, they were Byron Wally. He is a friend of mine. That's hilarious. I've just called him that. Byron Wallen. They were just coming in on a sort of ad hoc basis. So my point is, it was an extremely white experience. And I constantly thought about, you know, isn't this really just another iteration of very sad reiteration of colonialism, that we've colonized the art forms, we white people have colonized the black art form, and there's no discussion around it, which for me felt very concerning, especially all the students as well, were white, very privileged environment. And so as I metabolized my experience of Trinity, I really sat with that of, you know, what does it mean to compose contemporary jazz? We're like referencing an art form as a white female musician that is rooted in blackness, yet there's no discourse around that or awareness. And so if you're, for me, moving forward with that grant, I really wanted to lean into mentorship from people of the global majority to essentially inform my process, to constantly navigate that line of appreciation and appropriation, and under strong black mentorship and leadership, because the problem with our institutions is it's always white male leadership. So my quest compositionally was to really hold that in massive awareness throughout, because we reference cultures that are not ours. So like the Afro jazz band, you know, our singer's Senegalese, there's a Ghanaian guitarist, but a lot of us are white. And it's like, we're referencing music that's not from our culture. So how can we as white people constantly reflect on what we're doing to make sure we're trying to do it in the most respectful way? So Byron Wallen was a part of my process. So once I'd composed some music, which I had contact with Byron, I had trombone lessons with Nathaniel Cross. He's Theon Cross's brother. I don't know if you know Theon Cross, the tuba player, because I also had trombone lessons with the grunt. And then part of that process was, once I'd composed the music, to do some mentored rehearsals with different groups of musicians of different backgrounds in terms of race, but also gender, sexuality, age. And so I ran some mentored rehearsals with Byron Wallen. So he came and co-mentored it with me, because essentially in addressing these issues, it also brought up a difference, like, why are conservatoire cultures so white male? Where are the women? Where are the people of different genders and different neurodiversities? You know, it's very homogenous population of privileged young boys. So I really wanted that to come into the music, or like use the creation of the music to think about that, but also open a platform for communication verbally and musically about that. So that was how I used the DYCP. It had this very strong cultural element that I was trying to open up within the compositions.
Great. Because I'm just getting to the end of my Develop Your Creative Practice grant, so I'm always interested how different people, because you can, it's so amazing what you can do with it. And it's not just music, you can, it's all arts. You could do dance, enameling, pottery. It's just amazing.
Yeah, I've got some friends doing radio, one with it, and another one who's doing abstract art, and another one, a friend of mine, is doing like archiving of information around queering Islam. Like, it's really diverse what you can do. I know, obviously, we know a lot of musicians, and I think actually musically, probably the DYCPs for musical intention are among the hardest to get, because they're some of the most oversubscribed.
So this new one, what was it called? Record and Release.
Yeah.
What does that give you? What do you have to be able to show you're going to do to be eligible for that?
Well, essentially, it was to show that the body of work was ready, rehearsed, rated, and in existence, which it is.
Yep.
Arts Council, and that I'm ready to now record and release it, and that this money will facilitate that process. So essentially, it's about being able to fund a few rehearsals, get into the studio, record it, and then pay an engineer to help me mix and produce it and master it, and then release it with a like little mini PR campaign. So this fund will cover that, and I'm very grateful for it, because it's expensive to record and release music.
It is. I think people don't always, if you're not in the industry, people don't realize how expensive it is. Yeah. And also, you still have to license it, and you have to, and all the kind of dark art processes like mastering, mixing.
Totally. And then all the bits of, you know, getting it on a distribution platform, getting it on PRS, PPL, all that stuff that's so, you know, ongoing.
Yeah.
Journey.
And then you have to remember, I have a reminder on my phone, that's how sad I am, to once a month to go on to, I think it's PRS, and log the performances that you've done.
You're on it, mate. That's starting to get on it with all that stuff, which is terrible. But actually, so the record and release grant, actually one of the things that's been best about it is I get some mentorship through that grant. So I'm being mentored by Justin at Jazz Refreshed, which is amazing. Jazz Refreshed are brilliant. So that's more about the sort of actual trajectory of like recording and how I'm going to release it and gigs and that side. And then I've also get some mentorship from a guy called Eric, I think it's Nielsen, and he is an industry person who's super on it with like PPL, PRS, social media strategies, content, which for me, like, these very words make me feel mildly nauseous, but it's really helpful to have someone sit you down and be like, yeah, you need to sort out your PPL and PRS. This is, you know, really spell it out to me, which is obvious, but the, as a latecomer to music, it's always been one of those things that I'm like, yeah, later. But like, since releasing an album last year, and I'm on lots of other people's albums, it's, yeah, really finally got my PRS membership. It's happening.
Also, I think it sounds as though those mentors I found with mine, they kind of hold you accountable, which makes you do it, because we're not at school anymore and we don't have to hand our homework in. And that's basically what we need to be able to do, I think, sometimes.
Accountability and like sounding boards. I think I was reflecting on this like yesterday and today, actually, of like, when you're a driving force, we have to be the driving force of our own musicianship, our own practice, technically and creatively on our instruments. Then you have to be the driving force of your compositional practice, and then there's this musical directorship or leadership role that I'm in multiple projects, which is not only driving yourself but now driving the 11 people of your Maya or the 5 people of my quintet. Or it's so much energy utilized for pushing or driving something. And like you're talking about, if there's no one there holding you accountable other than yourself, which generally I'm a pretty motivated, driven person, I will step up. But for me, I notice it more in the solitude of that driving and the decision-making processes involved within it, where you are talking about risk-taking, like, do I release on this date? Do I go with this PR company? Do I record in this studio? You know, all this stuff. And you're having to make these sort of slightly gambled decisions based on half the information. It's quite lonely at times. I find, because and there's a sense of responsibility for other people's time, that for me having mentorship is such a useful thing, because it's a sounding board and you can lean into the mirror of someone else's mind and their expertise and be like, okay, how do I make this decision, or can you offer some insight? So I'm very appreciative for the various forms of mentorship I've had.
I sometimes think, and I found the same with mine, I just think sometimes it's a shame you have to pay to have that sounding board. Some of us and women in jazz media do chat sometimes and just bounce ideas about. And I think maybe as artists, we should be more open to that, because how are we meant to know all the answers and how are we meant to have all the ideas? Because some people will just go, oh, I know about this, do that. And they're like, oh, I didn't even know about that. That's such a good idea. So
yeah,
maybe we should start one.
Yeah, like a peer-led reflective practice group.
Yeah. I think it'd be well worth it. So how did you find those two mentors? Were they suggested to you, or did you
the ones from the Help Musicians?
Yes, Record and Release. Mm.
Yeah. Because the ones for the Arts Council were in my application. I wrote that I wanted mentorship from them.
Mm.
In the Record and Release one, when you write that application, there's a section where it talks about, like, all of these applications, like, how is this going to build your career? Like, how does this set up your trajectory forward to increasing your audiences, etc.? That's always such a big part of a funding application. And then it lists, and this is the amazing thing about Help Musicians, there's a list of mentors and you choose, well, what do I want mentorship in? And it's a really broad thing, but I was like, okay, there was one that was like specifically around jazz, and I was like, which was the Jazz Refreshed one, which felt very pertinent to my music form. So I was like, yeah, that one. And then the other one, which was about like social media and marketing strategies, and I was like, yeah, I absolutely suck at that, I need help with that. So it felt very clear to me. I can't remember what the other ones were on the list, but there was a whole, you know, maybe 10 or so options.
That's amazing that they have already done some of that work, so you can then choose. That's really good. Yeah.
Yeah. Help Musicians are brilliant. Brilliant. Not only have I got this fund from them, which has been so helpful, and then the mentorship, which is brilliant, but when you get this fund, they then contact you. I think it's called BAPAM, which is like an association of physiotherapists for musicians and performers who are very aligned with Help Musicians. They contact you and offer you a free consultation. And for me, posturally, as a 6'1" woman playing a trombone, I notice, and maybe you get this with sax, that like sometimes I feel like if I'm practicing a lot and I'm tired, like my posture suffers a bit. So I took them up on this offer of a free like physiotherapy consultation session, and from that they've like set me up to apply for some funding for some posture, like Alexander techniques. So yay to Help Musicians. They're a brilliant organization. You can apply for mental health support through them as well. Like they're a really, really good resource.
That's really good. So everyone should look into that, because they really do help musicians.
That's what it says on the tin.
Yeah. So how would you describe your musical style on the trombone?
That's a hard question. I mean, I could answer it from what flew up was my Massive Inner Critic. It was like, messy, sloppy.
Yeah, bad posture.
Sloppy tonguing. All that stuff flew up, which is, you know, the motivation for continued practice and refinement. Yeah, I guess it depends if we're talking about like technically or improvisationally, but I have this weekly swing gig, and sometimes I hire this really old school, amazing swing trumpet player called Magic Mike. And he's very much in the idiom. Like, he's obviously transcribed every Louis Armstrong solo that's ever been played, and that's how he plays. And it's so beautiful. I don't play like that. So I play swing gigs, but I'm not playing like, you know, this really like trad tailgating swing trombone. I'm there like, how can I get in my like, you know, tritone substitutions, and what about if I like play these altered scales on that seventh chord, which is not what 1930s swing sounded like. But I'm like, I don't care. This is this is jazz. This is harmony. Like my gig, I can play what I want. And I had a chat with this guy, Magic Mike, about it. And he was like, it's great to sound like you, do you, you know, like, yes, you could study the idiom to sound like Jack Teagarden, or you could just play the things that you're interested in playing and sound like you. And that was really nurturing and soothing for me, because I think when we're in idioms and genres, and if you take something like swing, that's, there are these fanatics who like love swing and they want it to sound like, you know, Jack Teagarden in the 30s. It's like, I'm not going to be that. For me, it helps break that rule book and just be like, no, I'm really interested in hard bop and bebop and modern jazz and reggae and dub. And it's like all of that kind of comes in. I'm not playing dub, swing, trombone, but maybe some of the rhythmic ideas I would use. So yeah, I would say I sound like a bit of a hybrid, a mood board,
That's good. And what drew you to the trombone?
Well, the question I get asked a lot, I was given one in a slightly intentional way, where I was studying flamenco guitar and I came back on holiday. I was living in Spain. I came back to the UK on holiday to see my best friend and said, oh, I'm really thinking about playing a wind instrument. And we sat down and we were like, oh, I wonder which one you could play, and looked up like videos of people playing trumpet or sax or trombone. And when we hit the trombone videos, we were both like, found it really funny, because we were like, oh, I'm quite like a trombone. I'm really long and I do loads of yoga. I'm very stretchy. And I guess it's quite a comedic instrument. And with this friend, we have quite a comedic, clowny relationship. And it was like, you're like a trombone. And then shortly after, a trombone appeared that she bought for me, this very like basic, like student Chinese made model trombone. And that's where it began.
Right. That's a lovely story.
But, you know, if I knew then what I know now, maybe I would have picked the drums.
It's a lot more to carry around, though, if you have a drum kit.
Yeah, it is. Just technically, I was completely unaware to how complex the trombone is, technically.
Mm. Mm.
But yeah, it's a full body experience playing trombone.
Yeah. And as this is a Women in Jazz Media podcast, how do you find being a female musician in the current climate of music?
I feel like I'm starting to notice changes. The mere fact we're here having this conversation is, you know, a soothing balm to my soul. It's like, beep, the patriarchy, beep. but you know, I think it's hard for me to distill out, because I started music so late, and then I went into Trinity, which was so male, and as I've said, so white and so privileged, and I was like the only woman and like an older woman. I still haven't like really shaken off that experience of just how minority I felt as a woman and how gaslighting that was. It's like, you know, you're never good enough, assumed to be bad because of your gender, and so you have to work twice as hard for not many opportunities. So I think even though we've moved away from that, that is still quite it's quite present for me, because it was a long sustained experience of feeling very invisible fundamentally. But as I started off this response saying, you know, I recognize the changes. You know, you and I met on a Women in Jazz gig, Women in Jazz Media gig, and, you know, with some other great female musicians there. And so that, you know, this organization is a wonderful thing that exists. It provides opportunity and support and resource. So long may this snowball and grow. I do hear, for example, like with my mentor at Jazz Refreshed, we had a conversation about part of my work and trying to find gigs and this whole thing. And he was making comments of, you know, we are trying to like give more gigs to women. And which is great, you know, there's like an awareness, but then it's almost like an EDI tick boxing thing. Like, are you actually listening to me, or is it just that I'm with a token woman, so you feel like, yeah, tick, I've like addressed that inequality? Or I don't know, there's always that kind of paranoia around, you know, EDI intentions, and I'm speaking from a gender perspective, but it's certainly true with race and gender and sexuality too, of like, it's about a sort of performative act of filling quotas, perhaps sometimes more than sort of hearing or meeting the actual individuals. So I think I'm holding, to summarize everything I said, lots of opposing feelings all at the same time.
Mm. And have you ever experienced any negativity with it?
Loads. Loads. Particularly tech world, I feel that's the worst version, where you're spoken to like you don't have a clue. Sometimes it's so ridiculous it makes me laugh. Sometimes it makes me want to scream. But yeah, mixing the album of Yamaya, the 11 piece, I felt constantly undermined by the sound engineers and technicians working on that album, which was infuriating because it's like my band, and I'd like MD'd the whole session, and it was tiring. So that's probably the strongest example of it. But then I guess other versions of it that often come up are like, I've had it recently on the Swing Quintet gig, like booking musicians, and then like a man, and then him on the gig basically ignoring me and only talking to the other men in the band, and me being like, I literally booked you, this is my gig, like, why are you ignoring me? This is can only be because of gender. Or I remember it when I was at Trinity, being in the big bands, you know, like 17 musicians and I'm the only woman, and like the band leader's offering everyone a solo except me, and being like, you know, if this is because I'm, and I remember saying to one of those leaders, I'm not going to name their name, but at the end of a rehearsal, being so frustrated and saying, you know, I've noticed you never offer me a solo, and I find myself questioning, is it because my solos aren't good enough? And if that's the response, like, absolutely. And so even more so, you should be offering me a solo, because this is an educational establishment and band, and I'm here to learn, and I need the opportunity to solo to learn and improve. And if your response is that it's not because my solos aren't good enough, then I can only assume it's because I'm a woman. And the band leader, a white man, was like flabbergasted and sort of flapping around and couldn't respond. But I was like, that is what's happening here. When you're so minority, and there isn't a shared lived experience from the person in privilege, there's a tendency to sort of, well, one, not even be able to empathize into your experience because it's so different from their lived experience. And then when you do raise it, it's that, you know, even if you say it in the most gracious, sweetest, respectful way, it will be felt as an attack. And so then there's an immediate like defense, or, you know, which tends to be attack back. So one of those things I think we're always holding, I think when anyone in a minority speaks up, that generally you're likely to be gaslit out of believing in your own lived experience.
That was really good of you to mention it.
That person.
Yeah, I'm still not very good at that. I'm a coward. I just take it and just cry on the way home.
I'm half Sicilian. I don't know how possible that is for me. You know, in the land of Etna and numerous volcanoes that can't contain itself, it's not part of the Sicilian psyche. And whilst I'm not fully Sicilian, and, you know, I don't see the Sicilian way as necessarily the most constructive either, and nor do I embody that explosive like rage with it, I do find like I have to speak my truth. Because if not, if you swallow it out of fear of the impact, essentially it's like, if I tell you the truth, I fear that I'll impact your mind or hurt you with my words, right? That's why we're scared, and you'll reject me, or you'll shame me or something. So we're like, it's almost like we live out of fear of impacting the mind of another. We sustain the impact ourselves when we bite our tongue. And I think that's a very masochistic act. It's very self-sacrificing, but there's a masochistic element to it because it hurts us. I'd sit in Trinity, and it was the strongest version I've lived of the gender imbalance. And I'd be like, no, if I don't speak up, like, nothing changes. So I'm going to speak up. And even if you all gaslight me and attack me, like, I can deal with that. Because you're not giving me gigs and solos anyway, so I've got nothing to lose here.
Yeah. Well done. I shall try and channel my inner Laura next time. Going to think of you.
Thank you.
So I know, I obviously we chat a little bit outside of a podcast anyway, because we met a couple of years ago now, didn't we, on the gig. And I know that you do quite a lot of work for charity. So tell me about your Play for Progress charity and what you do with that.
So Play for Progress is an amazing charity that offers arts therapy and advocacy to young people seeking asylum and refugees in Croydon, South London. So prior to the pandemic, I worked for them a couple of days a week, and they had a lot more young people using the services. However, the pandemic has changed the charity's territory somewhat, just because of, well, various elements. Not as many people are able to get into this country to seek asylum, which is absolutely horrific, thanks to our very conservative government, but also because with the pandemic and limited numbers in environments, unfortunately, the charity's taken a bit of a blow in that regard. However, it does still exist in Croydon, working in the Buddhist Centre. So my main role in that organisation has been co-facilitating therapeutic music workshops. So it's not specifically music therapy, but it's therapy, music carried out in a therapeutic way. So we're all trained and supervised by a drama therapist, so bringing in a lot of those principles into how we use music. However, in the past 2.5 years, I've also been doing a doctorate in psychology. And as that's intensified, I've had to do less work with Play for Progress because I'm in lots of other therapeutic clinical placements. So at the moment, there's a bit of a recalibration of how much work I'm doing with which organisation. But it kind of has worked well because Play for Progress were quite badly impacted by the pandemic. It's been quite hard to recover, as I was saying. So they still exist, but there's less young people using the services, which means there's less available work. But yeah, the work I do there, as I said, is co-facilitating music workshops. At points I've taught bits of trombone, but hardly ever does a young person come in and go, you know what, I want to learn the trombone. Like, I want to learn the drums, I want to learn the guitar. I'm like, have you thought about the trombone? It's really cool. And then the few times I've taught them it, you know, they're like, it's such a hard instrument. You know, it's very frustrating. It's not as accessible as you hit. And arguably, therefore, you know, not as therapeutic.
No, I see what you mean. Yeah. So when you're not doing your charity work and when you're not doing all your music, how do you chill out?
It's not my forte.
No, nor mine.
I do a lot of exercise. Which is really chilling out, but it's a resource for me, essentially, to become embodied, to be less in my mind and more in my body. So I do a lot of calisthenics and I do a lot of hand balance, particularly. Those are my main two practices, as well as bits of Pilates and yoga and like weights. But yeah, anything physical. And seeing friends is a massive resource for me. And trying to go to gigs. I don't get to enough live music, but I try to.
Yeah, I remember when we first met, I'd seen you doing some amazing yoga poses online. I was like, right, I'm gonna chat to you about yoga.
Yeah.
And you had that picture of you on a, obviously you weren't on an eagle, was it on an eagle?
Yeah, there were various pictures I made with my ex-boyfriend of me doing ridiculous yoga poses on various animals, because
yeah.
I'm teaching yoga online, and like, you have to obviously, like music, promote yourself, which with music it's like, obviously you've got to promote yourself, like that is the industry. But with yoga, there's this real edge that I find like very hypocritical and paradoxical, that in this philosophical practice, which is about moving through the self to overcome the self, that in the capitalization and Western bastardization of this ancient philosophy, we have to promote ourselves in this sort of yoga pornographic way of like, look at me, my leg behind my head, standing on my, it just feels to me like quite hypocritical. So I felt like I had to ridicule the whole thing by like doing the posts but making them hilarious. So yeah, I think there's a picture of me with my leg behind my head but on the back of a double humped camel in like under a full moon in the Sahara. There's like another one of me like doing Tittivasana, like an arm balance on the back of an eagle flying through like the Canadian or whatever. It just made me feel a bit better about the whole thing, that if I could do it in a hilarious pastiche way, then somehow I was laughing at this edge that exists.
So it's been really lovely to have you on the podcast ahead of your gig at Caramel on the 25th of April. I hope that goes really well.
Thanks so much.
Yeah. And I have two Hannah questions for you to round off. Drum roll. Here we go. The first one is, what would your desert island disc be and why?
Oh, such a hard question.
Yeah.
Wow. I really don't know. I'm trying to think. Well, and this feels quite appropriate choice, one of the albums I listen to a lot that has popped up for me in my head right now, so I'll go with it, is Dexter Gordon and Slide Hampton playing live in Copenhagen. It's a brilliant album, and it's a perfect choice because you and I met on this gig for Dexter Gordon's wife.
Yep.
So yeah, that album, you should check it out. Dexter Gordon and Slide Hampton live in Copenhagen.
Great, that's a great choice. And then the last question, what is your favorite time signature?
Oh, well, I've been writing, a lot of my music that I've written is in odd times, which I really love the sound of, but improvising on is very, very difficult. A tune called Signatures, and it changes time signature all the time, and I was like, can I write a tune that grooves even if it's changing time signature, and it sounds great, but then when you have to play on it, it's like whoa, everything is changing. So I definitely am working on odd times. I think for improvising, 4/4 is obviously the easiest time signature to improvise in, but I'm just writing a tune at the moment in 9/4. Which I'm enjoying. So that's like a 5 and a 4. So maybe I'll say that that's my current favourite.
I think you're the first 9/4 of my podcast. Very interesting.
Because you get the 4/4, which is my favourite, and you get the 5/4. And I guess 5/4 is kind of like 3/4, like the 3 and the 2, but you've got that skip of the 3 and it's in the 5, obviously. It's in all of the odd numbers. So I think for me, having a 9/4 and thinking of it as a 4/4 and a 5/4 is kind of somehow manageable, because 5/4 is, I think, one of the odd times we're probably most familiar with after 3/4 and 6/8.
Very interesting. It has been so lovely to have you on. Thank you very much for taking the time today.
Thank you so much for inviting me and welcoming me on. It's been fun.
Yeah. So thank you again, and good luck at the gig.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this podcast for Women in Jazz Media. We have a great back catalogue of podcasts with amazing women, including Claire Martin, OBE, Joe Harrop, Jay Steps, and many more. Please do check them out, and I'll see you on the next one. Bye.
Bye.